down in Mountain.
For the first time.
This is Jim. And,
receiving this message. We are Ken Jennings and John Roderick. We speak to you from our present, which we can only assume is your distant past, the turbulent time that was the early 21st century.
Fearing the great cataclysm that will surely befall our civilization, we began this monumental reference of strange and obscure human knowledge. These recordings represent our attempt to compile and preserve wonders and esoterica that would otherwise be lost.
So whether you're listening from an advanced civilization or have just reinvented the technology to decrypt our transmissions, this is our legacy to you.
This is our time capsule. This is the Omnibus.
You have accessed entry 385.PR0633, certificate number 36857. Dueling scars, but it's really dueling scars.
Dueling scars.
Dueling scars. Dueling scars.
Two scars.
You and I sit and trade off our different scars. What's your best scar?
I'm pretty scar-free. Let me think.
No dueling scars.
No. I used to donate plasma in college to like.
Oh, you've got junkie
to
scars.
Buy groceries. So I got needle tracks. Does that count?
Yeah. Yeah.
Here's you. Yeah. Do you feel like you're good with conflict?
No.
What does conflict do for you emotionally?
I'm somebody that problematically sees red when really cornered.
Yeah.
But I also don't like to be misunderstood. So it's really hard for me to be online because being online is all about being misunderstood.
And it's funny that when I mentioned conflict, you went straight to online. The only kind of conflict, day-to-day conflict we now have in our society.
For sure.
It's where you can find 100 people disagreeing with you in minutes.
Yeah, and in the mid-2015s, in the run-up to that election, all of a sudden what had been a very relaxed and fun place, Twitter, where we made jokes and slapped and tickled with our pals, became a place where people were screaming at me that I wasn't sufficiently leftist, a thing that I could not bear to hear, having been always far to the left of anybody else. And I remember writing people some mad tweets.
Manifestos.
Like, go stick it where the sun don't shine. But I've also, you know, I went through a period with where I was in fist fights a lot. And so
is that a different part of the brain and the psyche that, you know, that'll see you through a fist fight but somebody cutting you off in traffic will still make you mad in a different way for the rest of the day?
I've gotten in control of my traffic thing. I don't have road rage because I just long time ago realized, you know, if you spend 4 hours in traffic on an LA freeway and spend the entire time trying to get ahead, and then you look over and the same delivery van,
Volvo,
just right next to you, and they have not been stressing at all. All you have to do is do that once and realize, like, oh, we're all in this together. But, you know, the fistfight thing, it comes from like a sheriff mentality I have where I'm like, I feel somewhat put on this earth to resolve conflict when other people are having, you know, in public places, like, hey, let's take a little break here.
I'll be the grown-up arbiter.
Yeah, like it's something deep, deep inside of me. Like, I'm going to step in here and keep you two apart. But in situations where they turn that energy on me, like, mind your own business, or like ever push me or hit me first. Yeah, it's the see red problem.
And I had that even with non-physical altercations where I think of myself as a person who just
abhors conflict and would have my day ruined by a minor set to. But at the same time, if somebody like snipes at me, I immediately will, you know, yell back and then think, well, I shouldn't have done that.
You are withering on Twitter. I mean, since you've become
Twitter
on Twitter, since you've become America's sweetheart again, you've tempered it a little bit, but I've seen take people out.
Just never on.
Yes. Well, and on Facebook too, every once in a while, you're like, interesting, interesting dummy.
Dear dummy.
But
I never feel like I started it, you know? I'm like, right. Here I was minding my own business and a total stranger was a dick. It's the same thing where, you know, in an interaction in a car or a parking lot or...
Yeah, I never walk into a situation like, I'm going to kick some ass. I know. It's always somebody...
So I always feel like, I'm the good one.
Yeah.
Someone still started it. But maybe everyone thinks that they're the good one, you know?
When I was running for city council, they, you know, my team... was like, all right, what are your skeletons in the closet? And I was like, I got none. I'm not a creep. I'm not a baddie. And they were like, so no skeletons. And I was like, well, I mean, do you count getting into bar fights? And they were like, tell us more.
Yes.
And I was like, well, there was the one time and then there was that other time, those two Australian guys. And they were concerned about it enough, you know, that somebody was going to step forward and say like, yeah, he's real nice until he like punched me in the nose and threw me out the door. And I had to confront like, oh, maybe I'm not the good guy if that's happened more. It's like the early AA meetings I would go to and sit there and be like, well, you know, kind of pouty. And then you'd watch somebody come in also pouty and say, yeah, well, they say I've got a drinking problem. I've only had 4 DWIs. Like that's not, that's just normal. And everybody would laugh like,
I thought you were going to say you punched that guy. Then I'd punch that guy.
And then I got up and I just beat the shit out of him. And everybody at the meeting did. Don't come in here with that baloney.
Everyone cheered. No, that guy's name was Albert Einstein.
You only realize how dumb you sound when you hear somebody else say something really dumb. And you're like, oh, right.
And I see that too. I look back at some withering thing I said on Twitter and I was like, why was I? I mean, the importance of keeping your composure and just laughing it off when someone is a dick to you first is so, I think it's so elemental to the process of being an ethical human that like Jesus literally uses it in the Sermon on the Mount. He's like, you know, you should turn the other cheek. Like, yeah. Of course people are just going to be slapping at you all the time and you just gotta roll with it.
I see instances of it where someone just takes the hit over and over and you know, they can respond both wittily and also, you know, could put that person in a chokehold and they don't. And I admire it so much, and I aspire to it. Like Ken, I haven't been in a fist fight since 2015. What do you think about them apples?
Do you get a chip for that? Do you have a 9-year? You're coming up on your 10-year fist fight chip.
I am. No, I don't think so. I think even saying this, people are like, "What fist fights have you been in?" I don't think any of them made the
police reports. You should just admire everyone who doesn't reply on social media. Like, look at that guy. Look at these 6 dumbass things in their replies, and they didn't say anything.
What's interesting
is the most enlightened person on earth.
You know, not to ever mention my own personal Patreon, because I know that it makes you seethe.
Well, I just edited. I just told Mark to edit it out of the show. But did you not know that every time you mention on the show, it goes to like some technical difficulties music?
But I have a message board there, and it is the most. Like, if you are on a message board on a Patreon for somebody...
Yeah, you have to pay to be there.
You are really within a group of people that are like, I want to be here. And yet, there's still disagreement within that space. Even disagreement with me. So I'll type something. And I'll get somebody that believes that we're in late-stage capitalism and they're super mad about it. And I'm like, look, I'm just telling you that houses might have been $20,000 for the boomers, but they were making $1,800 a year. And every once in a while, somebody's just like, no, you're wrong. I'm like, what are you doing here? It's so strange.
I mean, people pay to get into Fenway Park, and every day there's 6 fistfights, you know? Everybody there paid $70 for those seats, and they're still like swinging away, so.
Yeah, but that's their character. That's their natural character.
Patreon's cheaper than most Major League Baseball games.
I guess it's true. But I don't think you can keep that kind of conflict out of the world now, just because there's no... I think if that kid was sitting next to me, he would see that I was about to get in a fistfight with him, and he would be quiet.
It does happen rarely in adult life, but It ruins my day when someone gets mad at me, and then I feel like, boy, I was forced to respond to. Like a few years ago, we pulled into a library parking lot so I could run in and return my kids' library. My kids were little enough that I'm still returning their picture books or their Magic Treehouse books or whatever. And so I pull into a 3-minute spot and I run in to use the book return.
Right.
And this old lady with some kind of Central European accent that I associate with authoritarian rule keepers comes up to me and is like, "This is a 3-minute spot. You cannot park here." And I said, "Oh, I'm just using the book return." But I'm already kind of like bridling because, like, who are you? And I'm just like, "I'm just using the book return. I haven't been here 3 minutes." And she's like, "You are not allowed to go into the library if you park in the 3-minute spot."
What is it for then?
And I was like, "Do you?" Maybe she thought I was going to use the outside book return. It's not clear.
I see.
But I just remember saying, "You know, hey, do you work for the library?" And she was like, "No." And I was like, "Then you need to go find someone who does, because otherwise, this is not your business." And then I was like, "Hey, kids, they're having a book sale." You know, I'm just a jerk. Like, "Hey, let's come look at the book sale tables." You know,
even somebody that works for the library, it's not their business either. It would be a meter maid.
They are going to be very unlikely to be really aggressive about somebody staying in the 3-minute spot for 4 to 6 minutes, I think.
Considering that there are 4 people living in the bathroom at the library at that moment.
But this was a self-appointed senior citizen. We now have a name for this kind of, can I speak to the manager kind of person?
Yes, we do.
We didn't at the time. This was 10 years ago.
So we were down here.
It ruined my whole day.
So, and then are you seething? Are you like replaying it?
Yeah. Like, you know what I should have said to her?
Yeah. Yeah. We were down at the tennis courts, not very far from here. And it's one of those where there's a code to get in the fence.
And you got the code because you live in the right neighborhood.
Yeah. And we went in, we had the code, we went in, but our little girl was there and she did not want to play tennis. She wanted to run to and fro. So we put a little rock to block the gate from fully closing. We didn't prop it all the way open, but, you know, and so we're in there
playing tennis.
And the rock is there, and an old
man.
That
would be cool if the rock was there.
The rock was there, he was just like, "Let's play
doubles. You guys want to play tennis?
I'll play both sides of the doubles." An older gentleman in a big truck drives up, rolls his window down, and I was like, "Hey, neighbor." And he's like, "You can't prop open the gate." And I was like, "When we're here, like, what, who's gonna come? We're in the middle of nowhere.
We'll guard the court. It's good.
You're the only other person here. I could see someone coming for 15 minutes. And he's like, "Damn, how about open the gate?" And I was just like, okay. And I, you know, and I do the like slow walk over, the slow move of the rock, just like, is this making you happy? But it makes me mad for an hour, but I've definitely,
you're still thinking about it. I can tell.
I've had weeks ruined by encounters like that.
And it must be almost universal that, like, to have bad feelings and have a bad encounter with another human being, just kind of messes with your emotional self. But there seems to be a type where it doesn't, right? There's the movie character of the mean lawyer or agent on the phone who not only is able to be like, "I'm gonna cut off your and fuck you with your own and then I'm gonna," you know, or Mark will bleep it.
Yeah.
But you know, like, you know, this kind of movie stock character who just can immediately pull off these insults with threats with 20 F words. And he's not just good at it, but clearly he thrives on it.
I mean, I'm in show business. I know a dozen of these people. You surely must, although you're in polite show business. Do people still scream at each other on your side of the show business?
Are you saying gentle indie rock is not polite show business?
No. Well, it's the thing is, gentle indie rock bumps up against actual rock music. And those people, you know, they're putting cigarettes out on each other. And then they all go into the hot tub together. Like, they seem to have no object permanence. Are you a grudge holder? Are you still holding a grudge against me for something? You are.
I can't think of any grudge I have against you, but I've had people that I think, years ago, I think had the opportunity to treat me well and instead called me in and were dopes.
Yeah.
And I still think, boy, that guy was a dope.
Yeah.
Well, and it doesn't really affect my life much, except like on a sleepless night, I might be like, "What should I have said to that dope?"
Yeah, every once in a while, you'll say to me, like, "Oh, go get another cup of coffee." And you're referencing, like,
something that happened years ago?
Well, just like, you're always doing that. And it feels like, oh, yeah, right. It's, I do that a little bit. Like,
keep score?
I try not to. I try not to keep score. I feel like that's a dangerous thing.
Yeah. But like when you're a person like us who's trying not to, that means you wouldn't have to try if you were actually a real enlightened soul, right?
I
feel like I'm trying, but it does take trying.
Yes. My sister rages, but then an hour later she's over it. And that's not me. If you rage at me, I don't make a mark in a book in my mind, but I definitely am wounded.
But it is an argument for rage, I guess, you know, sure. that settled it.
Burn it off.
In the moment. And I guess that kind of brings us to the historical subject of today's entry, which is a long, you know, millennia long legacy, at least in the West, of people deciding to settle scores and affairs of honor by doing controlled violence to each other.
Isn't it global? Isn't that also a Japanese and Chinese tradition and African tradition too? Like, doesn't everybody square off and fight for their honor?
Yeah, I was looking at the you know, the great thing about Wikipedia is you'll be looking at whatever the topic is. There will be a little paragraph that's like
Princess Diana sex dolls.
And then it'll be like Romania. Romania has not sold a Princess Diana sex doll since, you know.
Right.
Because there's some Romanian user. And then it'll be Indonesia. In Indonesia, the tradition of, and yeah, it turns out that
everybody
dueling is a pretty universal custom. But I just think it's funny for us as Westerners who, I think largely we spent the 20th century kind of tittering at cultures who have that kind of sense of, I must keep my honor. I have shamed my ancestors. I will never lose face. What a weird backward way of living, except that's exactly what the Western European tradition was.
I mean, there's an ongoing thread on 4chan, a place I never go.
And yet somehow know all the ongoing threads.
and the concept of it is, look, say what you will about white people, but their whole vibe is kill everyone, fight everyone, kill everyone. And they've only
wait. This is what recommends us.
No, this is just like they. It seems right now. It seems like white people are so wimpy. But if you go back
exactly.
In time, it's like they're the most murderous race. Be careful. be careful antagonizing them too much, because after they got done killing each other,
have to say there's probably millions of people in the developing world who have not forgotten that white people are great.
100% no. I mean,
at killing when there's a bottom line involved.
Once we killed each other for whatever, 1500 years, then we invented a bomb that could kill everybody.
the duels of Europe, the Middle Ages up through really the 19th century, they derive from an older tradition of judicial combat. Basically what you're saying, it's better to rage for a moment and get it. It's better for society to rage for a moment and get it out of your system, I think.
This is the Game of Thrones trial by combat.
Exactly. That was a real medieval thing, trial by ordeal or combat. And the idea is, you know, the putative idea, what you announce is that, well, obviously God will be on the side of right here.
Right.
So if you guys just hack it out with your swords, obviously God will smite the one who was wrong.
I didn't know.
And we've settled it.
Trial by ordeal. I feel like I could win any trial if it was trial by ordeal, because I can survive any ordeal. I mean, put me in somebody posted a thing the other day, like, could you live in a padded room for a year exchange for $30 billion?
But isn't this just thing where you're imagining you're good at an ordeal because you never had to do it?
Well, but it just feels like
I too imagine that I would be good at ordeals.
I feel like I've lived in a padded room for a year and didn't even notice it. But no, I subject myself to ordeals just as a matter of self-flagellation. I put on the hair shirt every morning, Ken.
I watch Family Guy just to see if I can do it.
Whoa, can you?
No, I can't. But even though this is this is what's announced, like, look, it all worked out. God killed Sir whoever.
Sure.
I think, in fact, the idea is this will actually, by having a structure, this will prevent violence, you know,
Because by
giving this official imprimatur, this will not become a brawl. People will not get their families involved. It won't turn into a feud and then a generations-long thing.
Yeah, you always feel like there should just be neighborhood stick fights and that would resolve.
Yeah, this is your whole thing.
Yeah, 90% of all conflicts.
If you pretend to civilize violence, then maybe you avoid the uncivilized, out-of-control violence, like fighting fire with fire.
Think about all the wars that would have happened between Boston and New York if it weren't...
For baseball?
For baseball, yeah.
But, you know, there's a tradition almost 1,000 years long of saying, actually, this is this is dumb. Like, this is not the right way to settle disputes. Like the Fourth Lateran Treaty of 1215, the Catholic Church says there should be no trial by combat, trial by ordeal. Priests are not allowed to participate.
What wussy pope was that?
Yeah. Like, you've got an Inquisition coming in 250 years, buddy. Oh, you're not into unfair trials? I bet.
Wasn't that long after Charlemagne was just drowning everybody.
I think, you know, the idea was to prohibit priests from taking part, but they were often called upon to be, as you imagine yourself in the bar, to be the, you know, they were called in to be the impartial observer of the, whatever the combat was.
What about all the monks that carried axes? All the shotgun carrying monks that were out, like, laying down the law? Little Johns.
Those might just be in movies. They wouldn't all be in the monastery together, right? That monastery would die out very quickly if all the monks actually had shotguns.
Well, unless the monastery was like, all right, boys, head on out. Keep the peace.
Oh, they like the Benedictines, like, go out and kill some Dominicans?
Yeah.
And take over their monastery?
Just wander the town, you know, swinging their axe.
I mean, that's more of an Eastern tradition, right? Like the advanced meditative Shaolin or Kung Fu type monk who also, when his back is to the wall,
right, can run across the treetops.
We'll have to do some flying kicks if that's what it takes to clean up this town.
Yeah. But also, you know, there's certainly it feels like Russian monks. Maybe it's just the one.
It's true that, yeah, there's probably 100 cool Russian monks,
yeah,
and they all just had their reputations ruined by one weirdo.
One weird monk. Maybe not even a monk.
There's a cool monk. Yeah, there's a cool Orthodox monk in Brothers Karamazov. So,
sure.
That guy can make up for any weird Rasputin stuff.
You definitely notice there aren't a lot of fighting rabbis.
Isn't that like a football team?
No, it's like
the yeshiva fighting rabbis.
It's like a Brooklyn baseball team from the classic era.
Exactly. They're barnstorming. These are all men we're talking about. I mean, you really can't discuss a topic like this without pointing out that today we would refer to this as just the ultimate in toxic masculinity, that when two guys are mad at each other, instead of talking it out or buying each other a drink or getting weepy about their mums, that what they should really do is advance to swords or pistols in the right era.
Yeah, I mean, it definitely takes at least 50% of the toxic masculinity out of the game, right? The worst dudes, only one survives.
But maybe the worst
two men enter.
But maybe the worst dude wins. Maybe it actually concentrates the toxic high T.
It still is why the average lifespan of men is shorter than women.
Because we seethe more?
Maybe. It's all heart disease, isn't it? But I think
it's related.
Yeah, risk-taking and cigarette smoking.
Yeah. But today, you know, like, if men spend more of their life quietly seething at each other than women, I'm sure that takes its toll on cardiac health, right? Like that lady who was trying to get me a ticket at the library, maybe she took 6 weeks off my life. Not because of anything she did in the moment, because a week later, I'm still like, what was her deal?
Well, you know, the problem is this: we're talking about his story, and exactly. So all those hair pulling fights never make it into the big tomes.
I mean, that's an interesting part of the history of dueling: is we kind of get the high profile ones.
Yeah, right.
We get the fancy people with their well ordered duels and their seconds, and they're slapping each other with silk gloves. But that might not tell the true story of how most of the duels happened in,
sure,
you know, country taverns.
Sure, in pubs.
It might have been a little
between wenches, probably.
Might have been a little less orderly.
This feels like a script I'm working on now.
Just because you said wenches? Did that made you think about your fanfic?
Just fighting, you know, wench fights.
Wait, a wench fight means you're not fighting with a wench.
No, two wenches are fighting and you're sitting in it.
Because a sword fight is two people holding swords and fighting with them.
Oh, I see. You're saying sick your wench on someone else's wench?
I guess. I mean, you don't want to be swinging her around. Boy,
that fanfic gets
like a halberd.
Even crazier.
But as you look at these histories, you can see, just based on kind of statistically when the duels happened and to whom, you can kind of see what the trends are. And it is often a very masculine culture that you would think stereotypically values this kind of old-timey masculinity and honor. In the United States Navy, between the Revolution, American Revolution and the Civil War, almost as many naval service members of the Navy died in duels as did at sea.
Whoa. Really?
Yeah. Like, you get these guys on shore and they just can't wait to get an affair of honor going.
Right. Wow. Crazy.
It's so hard to imagine now, to extrapolate from, you know, me getting yelled at in a parking lot to that, how that turns into 10 paces at sunrise.
But I guess it also speaks to how that, that period in American history, it's not really rife with pirates. We weren't in any big sea battles. We weren't fighting the Barbary.
You think we need pirates? They serve as a cultural vaccination against against domestic violence?
Well, no, but I think it just raises the death rates of naval officers dying at sea.
Fewer at sea, right?
Yeah.
But, you know, there could be scurvy or shipwrecks or swept overboard or whatever, and still more of them are just stabbing and shooting each other back at port. Stephen Decatur died in a duel.
But a lot of those duels at that period of time were just like, you looked at me funny or you stepped on my buckle or whatever, right? I mean, what prompted a duel was not much.
I mean, it could be you insulted my wife, but that could mean everything from you did a weird look at a dance all the way to you wrote a thing in the paper saying that my wife used to be a prostitute in, you know, across the river.
That seems like it would spark a duel, but like dancing with her one too many times. I mean, I bet you and I suffer insults worthy of duels every week and just like, that's just life.
Yeah, the insults did seem to be pretty minor back then. You kind of wonder if people didn't want to actually advance to violence, but were just forced to by the social norms of the time. Like neither party actually wants to risk death because of a slight at a ball or at an opera premiere.
That's certainly one of the subplots of the musical Hamilton.
Yeah, I mean, that's a funny case because, I mean, it's not really foregrounded in the musical, but it's a sitting vice president of the United States killing a former secretary of the Treasury. Like, if you think we're living in unprecedentedly violent, polarized political times in America, don't forget the time that the sitting vice president shot the previous secretary of the Treasury.
Right. No one has caned Charles Sumner recently.
Yeah, Mike Pompeo is not like strolling the cliffs of Weehawken with a pistol.
Well, I love those videos from the Korean House of Delegates or whatever, where everyone erupts into a giant brawl.
You think that would be more honest if we still had more Taiwanese-style floor fights in the house?
Is it Taiwan where that happens?
I've seen clips from Taiwan.
Yeah. Well, it just feels like if you're going to have all those cranks yelling at each other in the Congress, which the first time it happened, I was like, you have got to be kidding. What has happened to this country? And now, anytime anybody gives a speech, there's some ding-dong that's yelling at them. Well, how long before they're whacking each other with walking sticks?
There's no walking sticks anymore, but no, I
use a walking stick sometimes.
But like weapon availability is at an all-time high in the U.S.
Sure.
And the resulting violence rates have spiked in the last 3 years or so. And Republicans have the House, that you can concealed carry on the floor, right?
That's right.
So it's not going to be walking sticks next time.
It's going to be boot derringers.
Boot derringers.
Or Lauren Boebert's going to have one of those pink-colored AR-15s that they literally sell. Pink AR-15s.
But you have to imagine nice who girls. She's going to be shooting at. Like, what's the slight?
Matt Gaetz.
Oh, you think it'll be internecine Republican shooting?
That's the best thing about now is that
Democrats will be under desks.
Republicans are starting to do that thing that liberals have done for centuries, which is hate each other more than the opponents. Yeah, they're going to turn on each other, and it's going to be the best TV you ever saw.
But if none of these people really wanted to be in these duels,
but there was always humorless guy who really felt like the slight needed a reply. Mm-hmm. And then there was one kind of jokey guy that was like, I was just kidding, but I'm
forced into this.
Yeah, I can't look like a jerk.
I mean, it is probably like any kind of road rage incident today where there is one person who really has some issues and another person who kind of got railroaded into the situation. But back then it all happened very slowly with the exchange of calling cards and because there was the code duello was, you know, goes back to like 1770s Ireland. These list of rules that keep it civilized.
So like the Marquis de Queensberry, except for dueling.
It is the equivalent of that. And as we'll see when we get to like German student dueling, which is the subject of this entry, it is kind of analogous to the old thing about how like you don't want to bob and weave as a boxer. That's low fighting. That's cheating. It's honorable to see who can stand there and take the punch.
You're not supposed to float like a butterfly?
No.
You're just supposed to sing like a bee?
No, like, you know, if Muhammad Ali was in 1880s Britain, well, he would have problems for many reasons. But his fighting style would not be appreciated.
I have noticed this a lot in my travels around the United States, that there are different codes of conduct in different parts of the country. And people in Texas and in, you know, parts of Appalachia, they have a different way of doing things. And one of those things that I've come up against a lot is the notion that you're not supposed to talk shit.
Why would you be? You're a visitor to those places. Do you want to?
No, but they don't even want to hear you say a bad thing about someone, right? You're not supposed to say anything.
More like gossiping.
Yeah, it's akin to gossiping. But like, if this guy is dishonest, you're not. It's worse for you to say, "Oh, you don't want to deal with that guy. He's a cheat." That is also a breach of the code. You're supposed to communicate, maybe don't deal with that guy, but not go over the line and actually talk badly about
specifically.
It. And I come up against it all the time because I'm like, well, that's all we do in the West. We sit and, you know, like we just run down a list of each other's faults. It's a form of love. But I've definitely, with friends I have in the South, there's that sort of like, they will never speak ill of someone. If you don't have anything nice to say, don't say anything at all. And there have been times when I felt like, I wish you'd told me.
That would have been good information.
And they're like, well, you know, I mean, there's a laconic sort of don't say bad. And so I bet there are duels between those, you know, where one person like me is like, oh my God, you got to hear about this guy. He, you know, he pulls his nose hairs out and puts them in his soup. And then I'm talking to somebody who's like, you know, a man killed my uncle and I watched it happen, but I wouldn't have said. And you're like, oh, wow.
Dueling lasted in the South long after it started to be perceived as bloody and uncivilized in the North.
Like so many things.
I mean, by the time the Civil War had ended on both sides of the Mason-Dixon line, but I think there was a sense in the Northern colonies that this is one of those, you know, that we're a new modern enlightenment country. This is one of the old world traditions we're going to get rid of, like divine right kings. And
we're just going to sue each other.
Yeah, basically. We got sharp Yankee lawyers. And so there really was quite a bit of that. You know, Benjamin Franklin being like, I'm just going to say it. Dueling sucks. Yeah. And George Washington forbidding his men to get into duels. And a lot of that was just practical. Like, he was going to lose men.
Right.
He's like, let the British shoot each other for stupid reasons.
But you can see that as a way of distinguishing the United States. We're a modern country. We're a democracy, not a feudal society.
But we also had the frontier, which meant kind of a loosening of norms. And
that's another urban myth, like alligators in the sewers, right? That there weren't actually that
a lot
many
of shootouts at high noon.
Shootouts.
Right. Yeah, I think that's true. That seems like something that kind of derives from a literary trope. You know, we want to see the Western descendant of the Three Musketeers style duel of honor, which we kind of think is romantic. There's probably as you say, a fair wench involved on some level. So it, you know, it lends itself to a lot of different kinds of fiction for both men and women.
The bad guy is slow on the draw because being bad makes you slow.
Yeah, exactly. In America, you know, you hear about all these, you know, I said a sitting vice president was in a duel. In fact, it was considerably more common for these kind of high profile people to get into duels because, I mean, first of all, you had to be in a social class where this wouldn't have just been settled by punching someone into a haystack. And second of all, you had to be in a line of work that led to a lot of disagreements and enemies.
Oh.
So politicians disproportionately got into duels. So did newspaper editors. So did attorneys. It was, you know, the classes that today you'd think of would be kind of bloodless and isolated from that world. At the time, they're the ones making the most enemies and getting the most angry people showing up at their office.
Because it also would have been a time when your reputation was your whole status.
Yeah.
And if your reputation is that you're a sleaze, who cares if somebody calls you a sleaze? But if the only reason you're getting invited to the fancy balls is that you're known as a man of honor.
And you got some position of respectability in the government or the press or whatever.
And someone impugns it, even with a raised eyebrow. It's, what can you do?
A lot of
sue them.
And the honor involved is not, this is something I did not understand because I see duels through, as you say, the modern myth of the sharpshooter in the streets of Tombstone or you know, this great swordsman or John Wick or whatever it is. The latest John Wick movie, the finale depends on a loophole in the rules of dueling.
Oh.
So these tropes are still with us. But in fact, the goal was not to show your amazing prowess in defeating your opponent. It was to show your bravery in facing him. So, you know, that's why there are a lot of variations on the duel. You could lose your reputation in a duel by being too bloodthirsty. You know, mm-hmm. Andrew Jackson, I think, shot a wounded man in a duel, and his reputation never quite recovered because he won the duel, but not in the right way. By the same token, there was a technique called, I think, delope, which was to fire your shot in the air.
Yeah.
Because that showed your ultimate bravery. I'm going to face the bullet, but then that's the kind of thing that led to a bad end for Alexander Hamilton. For example, if you're too honorable in the wrong duel, you're going to take a bullet. So it's all very complicated.
You know, you think about the style of war at the time where you just marched in a straight line toward a straight line of people that were hiding behind a hedge.
Getting picked off one at a time.
Yeah, and you're meant to just stand with your breast out.
The battle is won by which side doesn't duck and run, right?
Yeah, right. Like it's just a war of attrition. Like how you started with 18,000 and they started with 15,000.
But our lines didn't break. Like it's the people who just kept walking ahead in the face of the fire.
Which made sense, I guess, when two armies walked toward each other. But when one army is hiding behind in a ditch,
and everybody else is still wearing bright red and standing in a line,
it feels like you're not adapting to the times. But there still was that sense of like, well, you don't run and you don't sneak, you take your knocks. It's hard to, you know, I think about Pickett's Charge a lot because I was at Gettysburg.
You were there?
I was at Pickett's Charge.
You're older than you look.
But I was on a Back to the Future hoverboard, and I was just flying all around with a machine gun.
I was looking at some interesting kind of academic work on what led to the decline of dueling. And, you know, you've got this kind of religious and civic disapproval for various reasons going back almost 1,000 years. But there's an interesting piece of work done in 2020 by some sociologists to try to correlate accounts of duels, you know, the prevalence of duels with post office density.
Mm-hmm.
Their prediction being that what leads to a decline in dueling is greater state capacity. Basically, the academic term for a strong, reliable government that you trust to keep the order and maintain justice without these kind of individual acts of honor and violence.
So as post offices go from just big cities to smaller
as they start
hubs,
to dot the countryside, should duels disappear in those same countrysides? And it turns out the correlation is quite close.
Wow.
Post offices come in, duels go out.
I thought maybe it was that you got your letter faster, and so if you wrote someone and said, "Sir, I take great umbrage," and then the letter came the next day, no, I only meant to say,
or if more
that
post
your
offices,
wife was very beautiful.
It's a compliment. Or that more post offices mean more disgruntled postal employees.
Must have come later.
That's a short-lived trope, right? Like the post office really got a bad knock from maybe two or three crazies tops.
Yeah, it's like Tylenol murders.
And then there was a generation of stand-up jokes. We should probably do an omnibus about kind of the forgotten
post office murders,
the forgotten trope of the crazy letter carrier.
These days, it seems so quaint. They killed two coworkers,
and it was like front page news for a month.
Yeah,
it really is. You can't think about this culture of violence and dueling in 18th or 19th century Europe without just kind of thinking about where we are today and like the ways in which that kind of let's settle this score ourselves thinking is gonna come back, but with AR-15s this time.
It's funny how much, again, the conservative pushback is always to arm the teacher, or you know, the more
let's make it more like a duel.
Yeah. So if they could defend themselves, then it would be fair.
Yeah.
And
often these killings I'm noticing a lot of these recent killings are defined in terms of, well, there was kind of a defense of honor. You know, this person walked in the wrong door or tried to get in the wrong car, or, you know, a DoorDash guy goes to the wrong, you know, or whatever. And someone had to, it's, and defending your house is not quite the same as defending your honor, but it seems similar, you know, like an insult was made. Somebody else tried to get in my car. Drunk teen tried to get in my car. Of course I came out shooting.
Well, these days, because everyone is an aggrieved party, even those people that go and shoot up a school, if you read their manifesto, they're the ones that are persecuted. They're the ones that are defending what they perceive to be America's honor or their own. And I don't ever see how six-year-olds get involved, but there's no one in America right now that doesn't feel like they are the victim, even up to and including U.S. senators.
This brings us to a kind of an interesting part of dueling culture that rose up Central Europe, Prussia, Germany, and Austria in the 19th century.
Which you think of as peak honor with nothing else.
Yeah, and there's some other interesting factors at play here because the setting is university campuses.
Oh.
At the time, to get into a university was kind of a rare mark of honor. And, you know, for the same reason we see stupid traditions littering Harvard and Yale and Princeton today, our elite institutions.
I beg your pardon.
You know, like... No,
like getting a tiger tattoo on your butt?
Well, I just, you know, skull and bones and saying Bula Bula and joining the Whiffen Poofs and being in Princeton dinner clubs. All these things that we would just laugh and laugh if somebody were to try it at UTEP.
What's
for some reason, because it was historically difficult and elite in itself to be on the campuses of these places, of course you had to have all this elaborate regalia and rigmarole associated with life there. And the same was true in Heidelberg and all the other great German universities in the 19th centuries. It was a real status symbol to be there. I mean, it's the reason why there's a fraternity system, right? Like, hey, I got into university. Let me assign some Greek letters to my name, and then we can do weird hazing and stuff.
I mean, the day that it's against the law to say Bula Bula is the day that I pack up and leave this planet.
You're not a Yale. Do you feel like you have the soul of an Eli?
Oh, that's a long-standing problem.
Wait, I think I got it wrong. Is it Eli Harvard?
No, Eli is
Eli Yale. Is Yale? Okay. Yeah. See, I don't know. I'm a good son of the soil. I went to a Western state school like all good-hearted people. So lots of dumb traditions rise up on these campuses. Not hard to predict if you've ever been to an elite U.S. school. But also, students had to travel between home and school, which meant they had a right that was normally only given to the very high classes, which is they could carry a sword anywhere without reprisals.
Oh, I see.
So in the same way that American gun culture has given us our violence-filled society, you now have university towns where everybody can carry a sword, and they've got all these dumb frills and traditions built around every element of their lifestyles, and they're college students, and they're Germans, so they are drinking heavily. Imagine how much a college student drinks. Now imagine how much a German drinks.
Okay.
Now put the Venn diagram together and...
I'm always getting in arguments with people who want to use the Gaussian bell curve to dismiss any comment I make to the effect that, you know, Germans drink a lot. They're like, well, technically, and it's like,
what
take
do they
your
say?
Technically and stick it in your ear.
The Czechs drink more or something?
No, the point is always that everyone is the same. Everyone is equal. There are no national characteristics. There are no traits. We are all just one. One happy,
I don't know if I believe that,
undulating people.
Culture is pretty powerful. Yeah. Culture is a powerful thing. I'm not saying that Germans are innately, genetically prone to alcoholism.
No, they
although
are.
I'm not saying they're not.
But the thing to remember also is in the mid-19th century, there was no Germany, right?
Right.
It was a confederation of almost 40 different states, states and free cities, right? So all of these university students would have also had some sort of heraldic, you know, connection to, you know, my uncle is the Duke of Schwabenstein.
And you're traveling through foreign lands just to get back to campus.
That's
after
right.
After you come from daddy's harvest or estate. So you won't be surprised to learn that there are a lot of drinking societies that form among these kids.
Sure. I've been to Schützenfest.
They like to hoist a few, and in particular, a very interesting tradition of honor and combat starts to form in these drinking societies because, you know, people who have had a few are maybe more likely to get into some fights. And in order to codify that and make it part of the culture, a sport emerges over those centuries called Mensur, M-E-N-S-U-R, which is kind of a a ceremonial dueling culture in which recreationally, instead of waiting for a slight, basically recreationally, people get together and hope there will be a good duel
to watch. They just sit around drinking until somebody spills a beer. And then they're like, all right, it's on. Right.
And the more beer, the more likely there is to be a slight, obviously. But in some cases, the slight could be very pro forma. You know, somebody could just say, hey, call him a Dunkhoff so we can have a nice mensur match. And I've looked at some, some reenactment videos of what these societies were like. And these are sword fights.
It seems like the more you drank, the
worse the sword fighting would be.
Yeah, right. Like sword fighting.
Right. Again, so in the style of duel where the point is to just stolidly face the bullet instead of to show off your great marksmanship, really good blade skill is not what's in question. There's no footwork.
I see.
Basically, two people would kind of stand a few feet away from each other with swords that did have, they weren't dummy blades, but they were maybe sharpened only in the last inch or two.
Okay.
And they would just kind of wave swords in each other's face, and you could parry, but you weren't supposed to do fancy footwork and duck and lunge. That would be dishonorable, floating like a butterfly.
These are like the lightsaber battles I have with my daughter,
pretty much,
where we're just supposed to stand apart and then wave our lightsabers.
We used to do this every Christmas with wrapping paper tubes.
Yeah.
And the point was never, you're not trying to hit your opponent. You're just trying to whack the tip of their tube so you can go back, left, right, left, right. And the goal is not to flinch. You know, you're supposed to be brave enough that you can take this kind of blade work
right in your face.
Yeah. And there's really no real honor at stake in most cases. The parties are not actually too aggrieved. They've just had a bit much to drink and everybody was hoping to see a good mensur fight. Let's see, you'd be holding the sword in your right hand, which meant typically, I mean, at first there are injuries as this sport develops. You know, somebody punctures a lung and then they're like, ooh, well, we should probably rethink how our drinking society works. So eventually elaborate armor develops, a thick leather. I mean, it almost becomes a smock because it goes down to your knees. The idea being that now there won't be any organ damage. You've got a gauntlet on your sword hand.
You've still got an eyes, nose, ears.
Or do you? So by the 19th century, these dueling societies are wearing what look like spectacles, but instead of glass lenses, they've kind of got wire mesh. The stuff you would make a fencing.
Oh, I see.
A fencing, what are they called? Yeah. Helmets?
Halberd? No, that's a different
thing. Sure, it's not a halberd. But are they helmets? Are they hoods?
Yeah,
what are they called?
Yeah, helmet
mask,
hoods.
The mask. Whatever the fencing mask is made out of
mask.
Today. You just put the Maskwa stuff on your eyes.
So it's like a steampunk Jules Verne style.
It looks very steampunk because this stuff is all made of leather. Huh. And, you know, there's some metal mail and their sword arm would have some silk drapery, which would serve to blunt any sword blows that could hurt your arm or chest or side.
And antagonize a bull if one happens to be around.
They made sure it was red in case there was a bull around. So over the time, this elaborate armor develops so that you don't get real injuries.
Right.
But because you're waving swords in each other's face and the goal is to face it bravely, inevitably the proof that you have faced somebody's sword bravely is that you got your face sliced up.
Uh-huh.
So the armor generally, although it protects the neck and the ears and any place that could really mess with your lifestyle, it's always very careful. They're very careful to leave the cheeks, particularly on the left side, and the forehead uncovered. Because you would want the resulting scars. That was proof that you had fought bravely and withstood the blade.
How deep can a sword slice on a cheek be before you have trouble chewing?
Yeah, I think these are pretty shallow cuts for the most part, but you want them to be showy.
Yes.
So often the practice was, first of all, don't have any real doctors there. It would often be first year medical students. And the goal would be how few sutures can I put in this guy so that he can go back in?
They would sew him up and then they'd go back in?
Yeah, or even worse, they'd sew him up and, you know, put horsehair or straw in the wound to keep it from healing nicely.
To be more gnarly?
The person wanted a gnarlier, more disfiguring scar because, again, by implication, I have faced a bloodthirsty opponent. I have shown greater honor and bravery in facing such a grievous wound.
Did they not want to get married?
Well, that's the thing. There was actually an aphrodisiac effect to having these scars. People would go back and would fight 20 or 30 duels. You know, one famous German student had 137 different facial scars because the ladies were impressed. It just shows how arbitrary all these courtship rituals are, because what they really like is badly healed scars from a drunken student fight club, basically.
It seems like such a risk to take, because some of the scars are so elegant and rakish,
mm-hmm.
and then there are some that are just really dumb looking. And you want...
Are you looking at historical dueling scars now?
Yes.
Yeah, so this produced a generation of Prussians right up through the Third Reich.
Right.
Which, by the way, banned the practice in schools, but it was too late. All the big generals...
They all had them.
All had them.
But like, if there's one that goes across your face, it makes you look like a really, you know, like a roughen.
Well, to us, but that's because the Nazis, you know, the stereotype of Nazi generals having these scars led to the 20th century trope of facial scars meaning
that you're
some kind of a sociopath, and you've probably got a bunch of nerve gas you want to put into the water supply of London and Paris. Like, Bond villains often have facial scars.
Yes.
And it's absolutely left over from this tradition as filtered through a bunch of Nazi high command guys who came up through these dueling societies.
But if somebody actually like cut off your nose, you'd That's be true. Like, oh, I rolled the dice on this and now I look really stupid.
Yeah, the astronomer Tycho Brahe lost his nose in a duel and had to wear a metal one for the rest of his life. And I think these dueling societies were careful. You know, I think often you would wear armor on the parts of your face you didn't want to slice off.
Uh-huh.
And you kept your foreheads and your forehead and your cheeks open in hopes that you'd get a bunch of nice, yeah. rakish scars there.
Yeah.
Because the Fraulein's were going nuts for that.
Well, I'm against it.
You think it should be shut down? Well, you agree with the Nazis on this case.
Oh.
You know who else wanted to shut down the dueling societies of Heidelberg, John? The Nazi Party. But there were the deadliest, you know, Hitler's deadliest general by many accounts is this guy named Otto Skorzeny, who should probably be his own show.
Mm-hmm.
He was the guy that hang glided into...
Don't give it away.
There's a daring rescue of no less than Benito Mussolini on his resume.
Mm-hmm.
He also...
if you're going to rescue somebody...
From a mountain chateau. I don't know,
pick a better looking Fraulein.
But and people would give themselves fake scars, you know.
Oh, boo. Some
stolen valor. People would have doctors, you know, slice me, Mick. You know, they'd scalpel their own faces because then they'd be indistinguishable from the bravest people at their dueling societies.
Super boo.
And you could just say you had a Canadian girlfriend. Yeah, no, I got this one in a duel like over the summer.
It's like shooting yourself in the foot
to get out of war. So this culture of dueling scars, you know, which we'd be tempted to think of as a kind of appalling night. Oh, and by the way, you know, since we've been talking about cultural relativism, you know, these same people who were oohing and aahing at the advanced honor and dignity shown by all these facial scars, I'm sure they would have been the first to anthropologically poo-poo any culture that was themselves tribal.
Yeah, ritual scarification.
Tribal scarring, whereas, you know, well, that's so savage and primitive. Whereas those people are doing it for the exact same reason.
You know,
this is a marker of honor and bravery to face this kind of pain in my community.
Right. The Maori facial tattoos. Yeah. Although there were enough European sailors that ended up kind of, you know, adopting those tattoos.
But they were all like, Mr. Kurtz is going native, right?
Yeah, I guess so.
So you'd like to think of this as a kind of a funny 19th century remnant of a Germany or a Prussia gone by. In fact, in Germany and Austria and Switzerland, this is still a thing college life.
Come on.
Certain fraternities, especially the more conservative-leaning ones, will have the same kind of, they'll come from the same kind of cultural elite that produces skull and bones rituals.
Except they're doing it in World of Warcraft, right? Or, I mean, or Rock'em Sock'em Robots. They're not actually sword fighting, are they?
No, they are still doing the dueling.
Wow.
It's kind of an outgrowth of their hazing and an outgrowth of the crazy drinking that goes on at these. I didn't know this, but I guess, you know, plenty of crazy drinking, blackout drinking goes on at U.S. fraternities. I don't know if you've heard of it. But in Germany, they actually have specific fixtures in every bathroom designed for puking, like giant puke sinks next to the bidet. And it's because they just know how much, you know, you got to clear the system to keep drinking at some point.
The Jägermeister's got extra flavor. it's got special herbs and spices that isn't in U.S. Jägermeister.
And at a lot of these conservative-leaning fraternities, there is still a ritual sword fighting and scarring going on.
So this is a nationalistic,
I don't want to say they're all neo-Nazis.
But you can't display the swastika in Germany now.
But there are other ways you can show that you believe in the old customs, I guess.
Sure, sure. Although, I guess Nazism isn't really the old customs.
No, they were the Third Reich. It's great. There were two other Reichs. They thought of themselves as the last custom.
That's right. The Thousand-Year Reich.
I think I've read that a lot of in these modern combats, you know, now that facial scarring is no longer an aphrodisiac for a lot of the sorority girls.
Although you and I, neither of us are German sorority girls.
We don't know. And you and I mean, I was not heavily scarred, and I was not a super hit with the ladies in college. Maybe I needed more grosser facial scars.
I've got scars all over my body, including on my face, and when I tell the rakish story of them, I typically girls just roll their eyes.
When you do it on the podcast, I roll my eyes.
Yeah.
But you don't have a big Blofeld scar. Maybe you should.
I get eyes rolled at me so much. What does one have to do to be taken seriously in this goddamn country?
I think today there's more, you know, the blades are more likely to be dummy fencing blades. There's more likely
lightsabers.
There's more likely to help. Yeah, they're going to be making noises. But also, they will try to inflict wounds on the top of their head because that can be hidden by the hairline.
A skull tattoo.
They still have hair. These aren't all skinheads.
Okay.
These are the good Germans, in quotes. But there are still these societies where the dueling scars still have the same import that they would have at, in Heidelberg or Salzburg in the 1890s.
I bet you there are students who are really good at giving, like, cute scars, and everybody wants to fight them.
Oh, I would you insult me?
Yeah.
No, I'll insult you. Here we go.
It's Helmut. He's the one that gave me this incredible... Where did you get your scar?
He's got a great light touch.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's the equivalent of getting a tattoo, I guess. Maybe.
Right.
Maybe we're keeping Germans from getting those weird gauged ears by...
There you go. Yeah, if you're going to get a tattoo of a pig flying... and also smoking a pipe, you're not going to want to just get that from a guy in prison. You're going to want an expert. And that concludes dueling scars. Dueling scars? Dueling scars. Entry 385.PR0633. Certificate number 36857 in the omnibus.
It would be like this. A dueling banjos... Banjo would be either a banjo you whack somebody with or that you received for winning a duel.
Can you imagine how many banjo fights, and I don't mean like playing the banjo, but two people squaring off in a holler with banjos, like fight to the death.
They've got real appealing handles you can grip on.
Well, and they're surprisingly heavy. Imagine hitting somebody with a banjo while they're trying to hit you with a banjo. This is not a thing that hasn't happened.
And it's not a thing you want to be clear, you're not condoning this.
I feel like if we did an episode and enough research, we would find enough documentation of people fighting to the death with banjos.
If I just Google the phrase banjo wound.
Banjo wound.
What do you think comes up?
I bet it's wounds to the soul.
Oh, and it's a problem because it's wound banjo strings.
Oh,
never mind. These homophones are ruining my life.
Have you seen the video of the guy who's in like String Cheese Incident or whatever up in the mountains playing his banjo, and a fox, like a wild fox, has loves his banjo playing and will come out of the forest and just kind of sit there and listen to him play the banjo? It's too bad
it's not Fleet Foxes.
If you're that kind of hippie, modern hippie, it couldn't be a more perfect scene.
It's Orpheus. It's basically our modern Orpheus.
Yeah, the fox is just like, this banjo. And he's a good banjo player. I won't deny it. Futurelings, in the unlikely event that you are a banjo player and are on social media and are listening to Omnibus and have attracted a fox with the dulcet tones of your playing.
Are you Foxworthy? Are you Jeff Foxworthy? You might be a redneck if you play a banjo to a fox.
Go on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram and follow Omnibus Project at Omnibus Project or at Ken Jennings and at John Roderick, the two of us. You can see Ken really excoriating people who dare question him on Twitter.
No.
And me just posting eye-roll-worthy sub-memes. But you can find us there. You can email us at theomnibusproject@gmail.com. You can hang out with other futurelings and potentially even verbally spar with them, although you'll probably get canceled, on Facebook under the Futurelings fan page and also on other social media sites and video game blogs. Just search for Futurelings.
Yeah, John's getting into esports.
Yep.
If you want to watch John play Call of Duty.
Yeah, I'm on there sharing secret U.S. government documents with my white nationalist teenage friends.
Good job.
Thanks. You can send us actual mail at P.O. Box 55744, Shoreline, Washington, 98155. Sounds like you've got some mail over there, Ken.
There's mail a-rustling over here. Andrew was listening to the Batavia episode about what kinds of Indonesian goods were making their way back to Europe, including the spice trade. He seems like he's on board with that. But then he says, we veered away to teak, ivory, saris, sitars, and gamelan music.
Did we?
Apparently he thinks we're maybe stereotyping the Indonesians a little too much. But he agrees, and he wrote a paper in grad school about the East India companies, and he encloses cloves and nutmeg, which originated in Indonesia. Nutmeg, of course, is a giant seed.
Looks like a monkey poo.
The cloves look like little nails or brads of some kind.
Sure,
but they smell great. He encourages them to leave these in the bunker. He must think we smell bad.
I could swear that all of that was just a bunch of psychedelic mushrooms. I guess if you put cloves and nutmeg in a bag together, it looks like a bag of mushrooms. But if you separate them out, you can see the cloves go in a ham.
That's right.
And the nutmeg gets what?
Malcolm X, in his autobiography, used to get high on nutmeg in Massachusetts state prisons, right?
Yeah, so that's one of those anarchist cookbook, like, get high off of this.
Get high on eggnog?
Yeah, get high on smoking banana peels. And I've tried them all, and there are easier ways to get high.
The nutmeg smells, I can't tell if the nutmeg actually smells or if it was just next to the cloves in the baggie. But thank you.
It seems like you're smelling your finger more than
thank you, Andrew. Oh, no. I was smelling the nutmeg.
Let's grind that nutmeg up and see what happens.
See what happens, yeah. Michael sent you in particular, John, a photograph he took. He's a professional photographer. This is Tybee Island. He includes his card if you're interested in his aerial video photography studio, Vertically Inclined.
I was just on Tybee Island. And,
did you mention it on a different show?
I posted a picture of a lighthouse on Tybee Island, and I heard immediately from Michael saying, I am a professional photographer and have photographed that lighthouse. And I said, awesome. And he said, I'll send you a picture. And here it is, and what a gorgeous photo.
It's a beautiful photo. It's a beautiful photo.
I stood there.
Dawn or dusk?
This would be,
Which way does it face?
we are facing west, so this would be dusk. Sun is going down because he's captured the light shining through the Fresnel lens at the top of the lighthouse.
Nice.
That is wonderful. Thank you, Michael.
Is that the lighthouse where you want to live?
That's fantastic. No, because it's right in the middle of a beach community that's full of ding-a-lings.
Elijah also sent us, first of all, a Melissa Tipton card. He's shout out to his girlfriend, who must be an artist.
What's up, Melissa?
Elijah loved your show, Friendly Fire, and so his girlfriend encouraged him to make that. It's actually wrapped, gift wrapped.
Gift wrapped, and the late lamented Friendly Fire.
He says he doesn't know why he's sending a couple of zillionaires some gifts. That's very flattering.
Zillionaires. The thing about this show is, for a lot of people, it is where they want to send all their shows or all their gifts for all of my podcasts that have been canceled. Well, this is nice. This has got a lot of references in the
community. Oh, to the show. Is it like a collage?
It is kind of a collage. It's got a lot of like it's a hat tip, and I like it. If only that show survived.
Elijah the Mechanic says, Ken, don't be too sad. I also got you something.
Don't be too sad.
I don't want you to feel left out because I really like Omnibus too. I think Elijah has put me in the friend zone.
I like you too.
It was created by a local Austin artist. It's it's kind of a Japanese monster themed to-do list titled Things and People to Destroy.
Oh, that's nice.
And then two either very small mouse pads or square coasters with other Japanese style kaiju on them, a flying eye with dragon wings, a big four-eyed armored demon man. Looks like LA he's rampaging through. I can't tell. This one might be, that's a collage. Oh, this is DC on the Things and People to Destroy. Thank you so much, Elijah.
My daughter is either at the age or of the temperament or both that she really keeps a running list of things and people to destroy. So I think we should hang that up here.
I think, our kids might be fighting over the things and people to destroy list. You really peak in your need for that in your maybe teens or 20s. Thank you so much, Elijah.
And on the topic of us being trillionaires.
Zillionaires at least.
Oh, zillionaires. Ken and I often sit and just give each other $1 billion back and forth because it's so funny to us.
As a gift.
Haha, think about how many poor people could benefit from this $1 billion.
We like write checks, $1 billion. And it's so short, you have to write the line. And no sense, you have to write the line
on the rest of the thing. Yeah, we often buy companies, hold them for a day, and then sell them. And even though the stock price has only gone up 3 cents, we make so much money, more than you make in a year.
We actually buy perfectly successful chain stores and shut them down and sell the real estate.
Shut them down.
I'm just kidding. Private equity does that. We're not that evil.
No. Private equity comes to us. but if you are a sucker, you can support the show, which I highly encourage you to do because I'm not a zillionaire. And Ken's not really either. He's only a billionaire.
What even is a zillionaire? Zero? I have $0 million?
How much is a zillion?
It's short for 0 million.
0 million.
Yeah.
So because you have so many million that it comes all the way back around to zero.
I lost track of how many zeros, so I just say a 0 millionaire.
Please do support the show at patreon.com/omnibusproject. It's not just charity or charity at all. You get a lot of value for your small contribution. You get even more value for your large contribution.
That's how contributions typically work.
That's right. Well, typically.
If we did it the other way around, I don't know how successful we'd be.
Roderick on the Line has a Patreon that gives almost no value except for a feeling of good heart.
If it does as well as we do, then we are wasting our time with all these amazing benefits and gifts.
No, it doesn't. Omnibus is a more popular Patreon, and I encourage that. Highly encourage it. So go to patreon.com/omnibusproject. It's really the only thing that keeps me from bankruptcy.
The streets.
That's right. Constantly.
And it's this show being profitable, the only thing that keeps me from bailing on John and leaving him in the streets.
There you go. All of the fist fights that precipitate lawsuits that I have to then resolve, that all costs money.
Keep John out of a bar brawl with your donation.
Also, I would never see Ken again. I would only see him on TV. Patreon.com/omnibusproject.
Listeners, from our vantage point in your distant past, we have no idea how long our civilization survive. Duh. We certainly hope and pray that the catastrophe fear may never come. The tenses in this are very hard to parse.
Yeah, you know, we've been saying it for almost a decade now.
And we still can't diagram the sentence.
We wrote this before we'd ever recorded an episode.
Seconds before we had to record an episode.
And I don't even remember how we cobbled it together. Written by committee, and yet we still say it every week.
If the worst comes soon, this recording, like all our recordings, may be our final word. But if Providence allows, we hope to be back with you soon for another entry in the Omnibus.